This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We want to urge continued water conservation.
That's James Brent Stein, spokesman for the Western Cape local government, on how Cape Town's water crisis has eased people, but people are still being asked to save. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, we'll look at the similarities and differences between two candidates vying for Nigeria's presidency. Political and business leaders realize that economic growth relies on sustainable use of the world's blue economy. And the approval of a controversial law by Tunisia's cabinet contradicts the Holy Quran. We'll have these stories and more all ahead on Africa News Tonight. As Cape Town gears up for the festive season, there's some good news for tourists wanting to visit South Africa's mother city. Dams are twice as full as December last year, meaning water restrictions won't be as severe. The city is recovering from a severe drought that lasted just over 2 years. Yashira Ramprasad reports from Johannesburg.
Dams in Cape Town and Western Cape Province are 60 to 90% full. That's good news for the mother city as it gears up for its December tourist influx. For the major part of the past 2 years, Cape Townians and tourists were limited to 50 liters of water per person per day. A severe drought almost completely dried up most of the mother city's dams and reservoirs. Now, officials say dam levels are higher due to some good rains. James Brent Stein, spokesperson for the Western Cape local government, explains.
The Western Cape province's average dam levels is currently standing at 61%. Last year at this time, we were standing at 35%, so a massive improvement.
But Brent Stein warns that the recent rains are not quite enough. Despite dams being twice as full as last year, levels have been decreasing slightly in recent weeks.
We are seeing the levels decreasing by roughly 1% per week. The biggest dam, the Tiavaders Kloof Dam, currently stands at 55% full. But at earlier this year, at one stage, that dam was nearing 6%. So it's been a big turnaround. But demand is picking up. The summer months, we don't expect a lot of rain. Demand picks up. There's more visitors to the province that comes in during the holiday period over December. Also, temperatures spike, so demand picks up.
Earlier this year, Cape Town eased water restrictions, allowing people to use slightly more than in previous months. But officials say residents and tourists still should strive to save as much water as possible.
We want to urge continued water conservation. We want to ask people to use water sparingly. The water restrictions in place for the city currently are level 5. It has come down from level 6B, but we just want to urge visitors to adhere to the local water restrictions.
Level 5 water restrictions mean people can use 70 litres of water per person per day. Over 127,000 people visited Cape Town last December. Tourism officials expect the numbers to increase this year. They've assured tourists that the water situation is better, but they're urging people to conserve as much as possible. I'm Yashira Ramprasad for VOA News in Johannesburg.
There was new fighting overnight in eastern DRC, and at least 6 civilians were killed. Civilian and military sources in the area told the French news agency today that a rebel fighter with allied democratic forces also died. The fighting in the town of Oicha led to protests by hundreds of angry residents in the nearby city of Beni. Protesters say they are tired of years of attacks by rebel groups in the region. The attack comes 4 weeks before the country's presidential election. It also comes as the eastern DRC battles a persistent Ebola outbreak. As of yesterday, there had been 421 confirmed or suspected cases of the virus and 231 deaths. Nigeria holds its presidential election on February 16th. The campaign officially began November 18th. President Muhammadu Buhari of the All Progressives Congress is running for re-election, while there are more than 30 other candidates. His top rival is Atiku Abubakar, former vice president and the candidate for the People's Democratic Party. Emmanuel Ona is a senior lecturer of political science at the University of Lagos. He spoke to reporter Mike Mbonye about the similarities and differences between the two candidates.
Well, some of the similarities are obvious. Both of them are northerners. Both of them are Fulani men. Well, and both of them have been in the struggle for the presidency for a long time. Buhari was once a military head of state, and then he contested the presidency for about three times before he won. Atiku Abubakar was once the vice president, and then he has contested the presidency almost at every other term, at least for two or three times, and now he's contesting again. These are some of the obvious similarities.
What are the key differences between President Muhammadu Buhari of the APC and Atiku Abubakar of the PDP?
For me, it would have been better to explain their differences in terms of ideology. Unfortunately, here, ideology does not really play much part in politics. So I will say the same thing in some other ways. For instance, President Muhammadu Buhari has some, we call what we can ordinarily call progressive tendencies. And then Atiku Abubakar has what we can call conservative tendencies. For me, they are not really purely ideological. So that somebody is conservative and another person is progressive does not really mean that one is better than the other. But I'm talking about their tendencies, their attitudes towards associating with other politicians. Atiku Abubakar associates more with those conservative elements in Nigerian politics. People who have been in PDP, people who were in MPN, people who were generally conservative in their attitude to politics. Muhammadu Buhari, on the other side, has associated more with the radical elements, even though he himself has not shown much radicalism. But if you see his association, even as a military head of state, he was always different from, say, the Babangida tendencies. And even in politics, he has never been in PDP. He was the person who removed MPN from office and all that. So that is how I look at their differences.
Why are they considered the top candidates for the 2019 election?
Well, it is very simple. Because elections in Nigeria are contested on a structural basis. In other words, a party is not just a party, but a party to the extent that it has the structures of elections. And right now, most of the parties don't have this kind of structures. These structures follow the structures of federalism in Nigeria. You are supposed to have offices in every state, not just offices, but functional offices. You are supposed to have offices and other structures in every local government, in every ward. These are the structures that will enable you mobilize for votes, that will enable you secure your votes on election day, that will enable you monitor the collation of votes up to the point of declaration of results. Right now, they are the only two parties who can boast of any modicum of such structures.
Is anyone else likely to come close to winning the 2019 election?
Anyone else from apart from these two people? No, based on what I've just told you about structures of elections, there is no such possibility at all. The only thing you can now say is among the two, who has more of those structures? And that is, once you find out who has more of those structures, then you have almost found out who will win the 2019 elections.
That was Dr. Emmanuel Ona of the University of Lagos. He was speaking with reporter Mike Mbonye. Increasingly, political and business leaders realize that economic growth relies on sustainable use of the world's oceans, seas, lakes, and rivers. And they say protecting this blue economy means more than catching fish. VOA's Ruben Chama reports from Nairobi.
Douglas Wallace is a professor of oceanography from Dalhousie University in Halifax, Canada.
Blue economy is really all of the economy related to our ocean. So that could include aquaculture, fishing, but also tourism, shipping, coastal development. But the idea with the blue economy at the moment is that we can make money from our oceans, for sure. And we can be prosperous from our oceans, but only if we protect our oceans.
Wallace is among the more than 4,000 scientists, environmental activists, business people, and political leaders at the first Sustainable Blue Economy Global Conference. It's being held this week in Nairobi. He says Canada has learned from its mistakes in managing water resources.
For example, we had one very major fishery, our cod fishery, which collapsed in the late 1980s because we took too many fish and we didn't listen, I think, partly to the scientists warning us we were taking too many fish. Collectively, across the country, we've got many examples. We have a problem at the moment with protection of our whales, and the government and industry are working hard to address that. So, yes, it can be done right, but it requires people to work together cooperatively between sectors, government, academia, especially government and private sector.
Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta decried the high levels of pollution found in seas, lakes and rivers, particularly plastic waste.
We are already feeling the impact of plastics in oceans. The 8 million tons of plastics that enter the sea each year are transformed into microplastics that enter into our food chain and impact ecosystems as well as animal and human health worldwide. We are already experiencing the impact of climate change, which risks triggering rising temperatures that would flood and destroy large sections of our coastal economies.
Speakers at the conference called for urgent action to ensure that the world's water resources are protected for future generations. Hannah Tete is the Director General of the United Nations Office at Nairobi.
The recent IPCC report indicates that if we do not manage to keep global warming at 1.5 degrees, coral reefs will disappear. Furthermore, improper marine management is resulting in overfishing. The lost economic benefits from the fisheries sector amounts to around $50 billion annually.
The blue economy provides food, jobs and the livelihood for hundreds of millions of people around the world. But there are daunting challenges. Almost a third of the global fish stock is overfished, and climate change and pollution are damaging ecosystems. Radolfo Lacey is a director with the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. He says there can be solutions to these problems.
We need to bring governance to the ocean domain. No? We need to bring better pathways, sustainable pathways in the ocean activities. Fisheries, oil and gas, transportation, you name it, tourism. All of these activities are must be sustainable activities. We need to bring the oceans again the possibility of recovery, no? To have resilient communities for us means also to have a resilient ocean.
The Kenyan government and co-hosts Canada and Japan organized the three-day conference, which ends Wednesday. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
Coming up on 19 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The Tunisian cabinet approved a controversial law that stipulates gender equality regarding inheritance. The law contradicts the Holy Quran, which states that men should inherit double the amount of a woman's portion. The Tunisian parliament will discuss the law and vote to ratify it or reject it. President Beji Said Abessi defended the inheritance law, equality law, saying it gives Tunisians the freedom to choose whether to follow the Islamic code or not. Sofiane Maloli, professor of media and communication at the University of Sfax in Tunisia, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi about the implications of the law and its chances of being ratified.
The Tunisian parliament is divided into four big blocks. The first is following Bourguiba's mainstream tradition. Bourguiba is the first president of Tunisia after the independence. It holds around 86 seats Islamist, 69 seats Islamist are counted as conservatives, and the left, or the far left, with 15 seats, and the progressive parties and independents around 30 to 40 seats. Till now, there are three official declarations and three official confirmations. The first is for the Islamists, and of course, it's the only bloc that refused the bill. However, two other blocs, namely the bloc of the President of the Republic and the bloc of the far left, they said that they would vote for the equality in inheritance. I would say that if everything goes right for them, the bill would pass because, mathematically speaking, the Islamists cannot stop the vote because most of the voters are for this bill.
Tunisian President Baghi Qaid Sebsi defended the inheritance equality law, saying it's giving Tunisians the freedom to choose whether to follow the Islamic code or not. What's your take on that?
The proposal of this bill is no more than a political maneuver for the party of the President of the Republic. First, because lately they had a rupture with the Islamists, because they used to have a governmental coalition with the Islamists. Number two, because they have lost their majority in the parliament, I mean the party of the President, and they look forward for the 2019 next elections, so that they can gather the maximum of votes to win the election. And also, the third reason of this maneuver is it's an attempt to provoke problems for the new government. This new government, which is a kind of a two-week old, which is supported by Islamists and another bloc that gathers parliamentarians who used to be members of the old majority. So it's a kind of a political maneuver on the part of the president. I would say that it's part of an overall strategy for the 2019 general elections, because since the revolution of 2011, if you want the majority of Tunisians to vote for you, you need to say that Islamists are the bad guys and they will get us back centuries ago if they get power, which is the common communication strategy for progressive parties in this country.
A survey by the International Republican Institute last year showed that 63% of Tunisians, including 52% of women, oppose equal inheritance. What would that mean for the country if this law is ratified by the parliament?
In some regions in Tunisia, women do not even inherit at all, even following the Holy Quran's rules. I would say that it means a lot for three communities. For the progressive Tunisians, it would mean a lot in their fight against what they call the Islamization of Tunisia. For the conservatives, for the Islamists mainly, it would cost them many voters, as they have always claimed to defend Islam and Islamic rule. One of the possibilities, it would provoke the creation of another Islamist political party that would claim that it's the defender or the official defender of Islamic rules. For the normal Tunisians, it would not mean much because Tunisia is a middle-class country that does not own much.
That's Sofiane Maalouly, professor of media and communication at the University of Essex in Tunisia, speaking with our colleague Mohamed El-Shenawi. South Africa's adoption agencies have been shaken by a proposal to deny birth certificates to babies born to foreign nationals. Many believe this is the government's attempt to clamp down on illegal immigrants who come to the country in search of a better life. Vicky Stark reports for VOA from the economic capital, Johannesburg.
That's one of the babies at the door of hope, waking up from his afternoon nap. This is where mothers can come to give up their babies for adoption. They place the infant in a metal box at the front gate and leave, no questions asked. A sensor alarm goes off to alert staff to the new arrival. House manager Francina Pajo says since opening almost 20 years ago, more than 200 babies have been brought to the home.
When we see a baby coming in, we know that, okay, God, you have saved one soul. That's the best.
While there are no official stats, some social workers believe more and more illegal immigrants are abandoning their babies in hopes they'll be adopted. ABBA Adoption Agency's Hanalee Turon explains.
If there's any proof, like a letter or a road to house card that indicates the mother is a foreigner, we have to disclose. But most of our abandoned babies, we don't have that information, so then we can register them as South African citizens because they're abandoned.
The Centre for Child Law's senior attorney, Anjali Maestri, says if there is any indication, like a letter, that the abandoned baby has a foreign mother, the proposal to deny birth certificates will affect them. Her organisation has made a submission opposing the move.
Instead of receiving a birth certificate, what they would get instead is what's called, in terms of the amendments, a notice of birth or a notification of birth. They would have to take this notification of birth to their embassy and then at their embassy obtain a birth certificate from the country that they originate from. Now, there's a couple of problems with that. Children who are abandoned would not know what embassy to approach. Children who are recognized as stateless wouldn't have an embassy to approach either. And children who are refugees also wouldn't be able to approach their embassy because their embassy is part of their country and they can't go to the embassy on account of the fact that they would be availing themselves to the protection of that country where they say that they need protection from it.
What does not having a birth certificate in South Africa mean?
They wouldn't be able to access the basic services which they are entitled to in terms of law. So in terms of law, they would have a set of rights that they're entitled to access. For example, let's say education or basic health, but they wouldn't be able to access those without a birth certificate, although they are entitled to them.
What are her thoughts on the Health Minister's recent comments that something needs to be done about illegal immigrants who are putting a strain on the system?
I don't think that the best way to achieve that is by making children bear the brunt of it. I'm sure that there are a host of other ways that the Department of Home Affairs and the Department of Health can adequately respond to those kinds of concerns without violating the rights of children.
Repeated attempts to get comment from the Department of Home Affairs failed. The adoption supervisor and spokesperson for Joburg's Department of Welfare, Griselda Bunu, says even she hasn't been fully informed.
The only thing I just received this morning was just a two-liner on an email to say that this is the move they're going towards.
The main opposition party, the Democratic Alliance's Shadow Minister of Home Affairs, Hanif Khursan, says he was unaware of the proposed amendments. I had to send him the document.
Because what the department does is that they create these regulations, behind closed doors. They get the public to make comments, and then they just implement the regulations. And Parliament itself doesn't have any involvement in that process. It's very clear that the department is trying to tighten up and make it as difficult as possible for children born to foreign nationals to be registered in South Africa. They've consistently acted like that. And to a large degree, that is the thing that actually causes a culture in South Africa of a xenophobic culture in South Africa.
Worsen says he will be discussing the matter with Parliament's Portfolio Committee. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Thomas Blondet, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.